May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is Beverly Bove, and I represent the appellants in this case, Tasha Wilson and Jermaine Emery, the parents of the decedent. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
The amber light will come on when you have 3 minutes left.
Thank you. This is the de novo review of the dismissal of the second complaint filed in this case. The second action was timely filed before the statute of limitations. The court may recall this action was dismissed res judicata. The first action was procedurally defaulted and affirmed by this court in April of last year. After the first action was affirmed, the stay in the second action was lifted, and the court dismissed res judicata. The issue before
on the basis that the claim that was asserted in the second complaint could have been asserted in the first action and wasn't, and therefore is barred, correct?
That's partially correct, Your Honor. But the court also said in the dismissal of the action that the parents proceeded to or made the choice to go forward on the first action as opposed to consolidating both actions or proceeding on the second action, which is not the case.
Help me understand procedurally how this would work. A civil action is filed, and the court enters a scheduling order, and the scheduling order says this is the deadline for motions to amend, and then we're proceeding to a trial date. And the scheduling order basically bars, absent manifest injustice, a change in that process so that there could be no amendments. Can that always be circumvented by filing another action, a separate civil action, and then moving to consolidate? Isn't that accomplishing indirectly what you cannot do directly?
I understand the court's question. However, the filing of the second action was a last-ditch effort on the part of the parents to preserve the claim. We attempted in the first action to amend the complaint, and we also asserted in the first action, which we thought the attractive nuisance was pled by reference in the first complaint. And correct, when we were not permitted during the arguing of the motion for summary judgment to amend the complaint pursuant to Rule 15, which is permitted at any time up until the trial, when we were not permitted to amend that complaint, that is why we filed the second action to preserve the attractive nuisance complaint and requested that the actions be consolidated.
Well, yeah, we read what's characterized as the cold record, but I have to tell you, in all of my years on the court, I haven't read a record where the trial judge was so upset about what was going on. Is that a general concern she had, or was it specific to this case?
It's hard to tell, Your Honor. I think the reading of the record was that it might be specific to this case, but I don't know why.
Well, I think it relates to Justice Ridgely's question if it's specific to this case. She seemed to imply the case had been scheduled and was moving forward, and it was now time to have a trial, and then the motion came up, and the court simply wasn't going to allow there to be a second complaint to, quote, do an end run on what had been the scheduling order. Do we look at that? I assume the question is abuse of discretion. Is that right? Or is there a legal error?
The position in this case, Your Honor, is that the dismissal of the second complaint, actually all the actions taken together, including the dismissal of the second complaint, was a punitive effort. The plaintiffs had never been sanctioned in this case for any violation of any discovery rule or a scheduling deadline, and the theory was not a new theory in the case. We had pled it by reference in the first complaint.
Ms. Bove, I just need to know in a sentence, what is the error that you contend the trial court made?
Two errors.
It requires reversal.
Two errors, Your Honor. Number one is asserting in the opinion that it was the plaintiffs who made the choice to go forward on the first complaint, and we did not. We hadn't made a decision whether to go forward on the first or the second, and the transcript of that office conference on the consolidation motion, which is at tab C of our complaint or our opening brief, and at pages 28, 29, and 31, the court made the decision for the plaintiffs. At the conclusion, or nearly the conclusion of that argument, the court said then this is easy for me. I will go forward with the first complaint. The other will go through the process of being scheduled. It will be res judicata, I'm sure, because the trial is scheduled in July, I think.
Well, I'm looking at, I believe it is page 13 of your brief, and it reads, and I'm just reading from one portion of it, as evident from the hearing transcript from parents' motion to consolidate, the court below never gave the parents the choice to dismiss the first action in favor of the second. Indeed, the court below refused to consolidate the actions and made the parents pursue both actions at the same time. Is that what you're claiming was the error?
Yes, Your Honor, and it was basically a sanction.
If that's the case, then how do you confront this statement that was made by the court, and it's found at page 20 of the transcript of the hearing that was held on May 14th, 2010. I'm sorry, I don't have a an appendix reference. But the court says, and I'm quoting, here's what's going to happen. You get two choices, okay? The defendants are pretty nice to you, frankly, because I was going to say you go forward with one complaint or the other, okay? If you want to go forward with the one was first filed, I'll decide the motions will go forward if necessary to trial, and you'll go to trial just on what's in that complaint. And then after that, it will be res judicata, so your second one will be gone. Okay, you can do it that way. Or you can dismiss this one, that is the first case, and go with the second one so that they will then have an opportunity to develop their case, knowing what your allegations are and what it is that you're claiming, because it is not clear. I mean, I don't think your original complaint is as clear as it should be, and it wasn't to them, obviously. But if that's the case, they have to do new discovery, I would think. So weren't you given a choice?
If you read on, Your Honor, to get to, there was a back-and-forth exchange between counsel, co-counsel, and the court. And on page 28 is where the court decides to make the decision. We were never given the opportunity to make the decision by the end of the conference. The court made the decision and said we would go forward.
That's because your clients wouldn't decide for themselves. Isn't that what the record shows?
I don't believe that's what it shows, Your Honor. We were trying to answer the court's question during that. The transcript of that conference shows that until the court finally made the decision.
And was there, does the record show that either you or Mr. Hedrick objected to what the court did as being forced upon the plaintiffs?
I don't know that the record reflects that, Your Honor. I think we were.
I read this several times. And I don't have the paper right in front of me, but at some point, I believe the trial judge said, if you're going to pursue the second matter at this late stage, the second complaint, you're going to have to compensate the other side for discovery costs. Didn't the trial judge say something to that effect?
I think that was part of this whole exchange during the conference, but we would have been gladly to do that. The only discovery that would have been necessary may have been two depositions of the property owners. The Browns certainly weren't going to take their own depositions again, and we would have gladly paid discovery costs and could have gotten that done before the first trial date had we been allowed to do so.
Well, the reason I asked the question is because, and the reason I reread it a few times is because I kept thinking to myself, I'm missing something. If you were willing to pay discovery costs, I couldn't find where anybody said, we're willing to do that, end of problem. On the other hand, I said to myself, well, maybe there was some signal that they wouldn't pay discovery costs. And so the judge said, if you're not going to pay the discovery costs, here's the ruling that Justice Jacobs read. But apparently, this all took place. But the specific issue of paying for discovery costs or not paying for them, I can't find in the record.
Because we were never told that we could do that, Your Honor. By the end of that office conference, it was decided by the court that we would go forward with the second action, with the first action, rather, which obviously bootstrapped the second action into being dismissed. There was never a sanction imposed on counsel or the plaintiffs anywhere along the line, and obviously we irritated the court doing everything we could to get this claim before the court. It was not a new theory.
The cause of the second, the reason for the second action is because a motion to amend was denied in the first action?
During the course of the briefing on the motion for summary judgment, we asked during that briefing and our brief that we be allowed to amend during Rule 15 or pursuant to Rule 15, which can be done at any time, in the interest of justice. We were never permitted to do that. The summary judgment motion was simply granted.
But was there a denial of your application to amend?
There wasn't a separate application to amend, Your Honor. We just argued in the briefing that we'd be allowed to do that because in the interest of justice, Rule 15 allows that you can amend at any time during...
I'm sorry, you did ask for leave to amend the complaint in the first action to allege a claim, the claim that ended up being in the second action, attractive nuisance, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. During the briefing of the motion...
The court denied that motion, correct?
I'm sorry?
The court denied that motion to amend, correct?
Granted the motion for summary judgment.
Right. You then embodied that theory of recovery in an independent second action.
Correct.
And moved to consolidate second action with the first action.
Correct.
The court denied the consolidation.
Correct.
And said you either go with the first or the second.
The court did not say that. The court told us we would go forward with the first.
You can go forward with the first or the second. And then somewhere later in the conference decided that you would go forward with the first.
The court decided.
The second would be res judicata, whatever the outcome of the first was. Your claim is that that was foisted on you. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
My question again is there anywhere in the record where you objected after the court said, I'm going forward with the first, on the ground that you were deprived of the choice that the court said you had?
Other than arguing in the motion for summary judgment that we should be allowed to amend pursuant to Rule 15.
Well, didn't after the court in the oral ruling said, this is an easy decision for me, we'll go with the first, didn't somebody on your side get up and say, wait a minute, Your Honor, I thought we had a choice here?
The court had ruled, Your Honor. I don't know that we had any choice once the court ruled.
Well, you had a choice to appeal, ultimately, correct?
We did. We appealed the first case.
Okay. And so this argument as to what the trial court did or failed to do in the first case could have been raised on direct appeal?
We did raise that on direct appeal, Your Honor,
and
that we weren't allowed to amend.
So that has been adjudicated?
Correct.
And affirm?
Yes, the first action. Correct, Your Honor.
And part of that issue was your contention that we incorporated this theory against the host, so to speak, by reference in the first complaint.
Correct.
But the court rejected that, and that was affirmed on appeal. Is that correct?
Yes, it was procedurally defaulted.
So that's not really an issue when we're looking at this particular complaint. In looking at the complaint that was dismissed, the one that was stayed and subsequently dismissed for res judicata that's before us, tell us succinctly the error of law that led to the improper dismissal of this second complaint.
The error of law, Your Honor, is that the dismissal of the complaint was basically imposed as a sanction against the plaintiffs. And that's in violation of Draca versus Hitchens. There were never any violations found by the plaintiff or any sanctions imposed by the plaintiff before. And under Draca, there are six factors. There was no prejudice to the defense, and the defense doesn't say that there's any prejudice in their briefing and going forward. We tried everything we could to get that attractive nuisance, as we well thought was pled in the first case by reference, and tried to amend, tried to consolidate. Secondly, there is no dilatoriness on the part of the plaintiffs. The tort issue before the case in the attractive nuisance is simple. Whether the Browns had control of that pool and the deck for the purposes of that party, and whether or not they breached their duty of simple negligence to prevent the death of Damon.
We understand that. I think what we're trying to understand is how the procedural posture of the two cases gets intertwined. Because it's your position that if we read the first complaint that was dismissed and affirmed by this court, we would have seen clearly that all of the allegations in your complaint incorporated the attractive nuisance allegations as to everybody. And the Superior Court didn't see it that way the first time, and this court affirmed it. Now, in arguing that this second complaint shouldn't have been dismissed, You're characterizing it as sanctions, but the way the Superior Court characterized it is you're splitting your causes of action. And that's based on the Superior Court's position that attractive nuisance as to the Browns was never legitimately in the first case. Now, if we assume that attractive nuisance was never legitimately against the Browns in the first case, and that's been decided, why isn't this splitting causes of action that would be barred by res judicata?
Because the plaintiffs had a valid reason for filing the second action to preserve that attractive nuisance, which the court didn't think was properly pled in the first action. And the action was filed timely and in order to preserve that action. And the court made the choice. There were three options, either dismiss the first action amend the first action to allow the amendment of the attractive nuisance to satisfy the court. The second was consolidate the actions, or the third was go forward on the second action. According to the transcript of that office conference, we were not given that choice, any choice, but to go forward on the first, which bootstrapped the second case into dismissal.
So what, help me understand, the exception to res judicata, the doctrine of res judicata is what? As a rule of law that you are asking us to adopt?
I guess in this case, Your Honor, too. First is that the basis for the dismissal was incorrect. It was factually incorrect. We were not given the choice. The choice was made by the court to go forward in the first action. And secondly, that res judicata decision was used as a punishment against the plaintiffs. And that violates DRECA. And there's absolutely no reason. The valid reason for filing the second complaint was that we thought it was properly pled in the first complaint. The court ruled not. We weren't outside the statute of limitations. There was no prejudice to the defense. So we filed the second action to preserve that claim. It could have easily been consolidated by the court and gone forward with the same trial date.
Well, that argument then amounts to an abuse of discretion claim. Is that correct?
I guess yes, Your Honor.
Did you want to save this remaining time?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Your Honor.
Afternoon, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. May it please the court, my name is Arthur Kuhl. I represent the defendants below, appellees on this matter. It is our position this is a textbook case of res judicata, as was probably beaten to death. The first case was litigated, briefed, appealed, argued, and affirmed. That included the consolidation issue of the second suit that was filed during the pendency and the decision process of the summary judgment motion in the first case. There are no disputes that all the elements necessary for res judicata to bar the second complaint are present. And there's no dispute that the exceptions to it, that if there was an impediment, fraud, or collusion, are not present.
Let's assume everything you say is correct and this clearly is res judicata. And Ms. Bove's point is that the reason res judicata applies at all is because she was given a choice, arguably, and then before she ever had a chance to make a choice, the choice was taken away from her. And when the choice was taken away from her, this was going to be res judicata. So she doesn't dispute the fact that it's res judicata for purposes of my question. What she's really saying is I shouldn't have been put in the predicament of being barred by res judicata because I was given a choice and then never allowed to make it.
I think that, number one, the issue of claim splitting is there as soon as the second suit is filed. So the choice, if one was given, I don't think should ever have been offered in the first place. You don't get to decide which of your two and theoretically three, four, or five lawsuits you're going to go with if you file a string of them. There was a long discussion
Mr. Kuhl, just to make sure we're on the same track here, in response to Justice Hall's question, we're still trying to figure out what exactly happened.
you know, I think I can answer that, is there was this discussion, it was the judge's first thought, I mean, which is sort of an informal office conference, you know, are we going to go forward with the first one or the second one? I chime in because I am not going to agree after 2 years of litigating the first case and summary judgment has been filed. I see the response. I'm feeling good about our summary judgment motion that I'm going to voluntarily dismiss the first suit without prejudice to only start and put my clients through another 2 years of litigation on the same issues. So I went through this long analysis with the court of, well, it's not as easy as getting rid of the first case. Two of the defendants or three had already been dismissed. They were going to be brought back in. And it never got to the point where a final decision had to be made. If I could point the court out to page 32, which is Exhibit A135, line 4, the court asked plaintiff's counsel directly, so what are you going to do with the second one? Are you going to dismiss it or just leave it? And the answer was, I'll discuss it with Ms. Bove and our clients. Given that, I don't think the court has any choice. It has two lawsuits that were filed that are open and pending.
Well, but do you agree with my earlier question that along the way, the judge also said something about covering the cost of discovery if they went that way?
That was an option that if there was an application, I think it was, that she would transfer some of the costs that for any duplicative discovery that would need to be done that couldn't have been done or wasn't done in the first one.
Well, I say that in response to what you just read, because it seems logical to say, I'll discuss it with Ms. Bove and my clients, because one of the options was going to
be expensive.
They were going to be out of pocket. But as I read the rest of the transcript, there was never an opportunity to talk to the clients or Ms. Bove, because as the conversation went on, the judge said, okay, this is simple. So it appears that while a choice was offered, it was subsequently taken away by a ruling.
I'm not sure it was taken away by a ruling. There was no decision from the plaintiffs during this office conference as to exactly what they wanted to do. I don't think the court has a choice. It's
well,
got a case pending.
What the record says is what they wanted to do was discuss with Ms. Bove and the clients the choice, because one choice was out of pocket. You would think if that wasn't okay to discuss the expenditure of money, the court would have said, look, we're here now, I'm going to make a ruling now, there's no discussing it with your client and Ms. Bove, you're here, what's your choice? But yeah, we don't see that in the record.
That wasn't. My reading and from participating was at the end of the office conference, the ball was in the plaintiff's court to decide what they were going to do. Make an application, you know, do something. As we left basically the way we came in. There was two lawsuits filed. The only real decision was that they were not going to be consolidated.
Why did there have to be two lawsuits?
I don't know. That was the second lawsuit was filed simultaneously or very in close proximity to the response to our summary judgment motion.
The parties and everyone was identical in both lawsuits?
Same. It's the same claim. There were both wrongful death claims by the same plaintiffs against the same defendants. This all started as a response to our summary judgment motion, included allegations that we didn't address the
Well, the record indicates the homeowners settled. Is that right?
Yes.
So then in this new
suit, and the babysitter settled. So only the Browns were left.
So when it's suggested that the new suit would have brought people back who were long gone, they might have been brought back as witnesses, but they were out of the case probably under a joint tortfeasor release?
That's the attempt. However, once the whole attractive nuisance got involved with the Browns and there's this allegation that, well, now the Browns have possession of the property, you know, my mind starts thinking, well, there has to be some sort of transaction that transfers the control or possession from the homeowners to the Browns. There's some sort of claim that can be made back against the homeowners that are not tort-based, therefore the tort joint tortfeasor release would have no application if it's not a tort claim going back. None of that ever got played out because we never filed an answer to the second lawsuit. We never had to bring in any third-party complaints. We filed a pre-answer motion to dismiss on claim splitting. It was stayed and dismissed.
Let me follow up. You said that at the conclusion of the conference, both actions were going forward and they were without being consolidated.
Correct. That was the only actual decision.
How much time, how long before the trial of the first action did that take place? In other words, how much?
The office conference was, I believe, May 14th, and trial was the first week of August. I'm going to say August 3rd.
So there was roughly two and a half to three months.
About 3 months with
which,
the court still having.
There could have been a discussion with Ms. Bove and with the clients, and presumably during that time, if there was a decision to dismiss the first action and proceed in the second, that choice could have been made.
There was time, plus there was some additional time shorter on because the court
answer my question.
Yes, there was time, plus the court allowed additional time to respond.
All right.
And
was there any communication with the court from the end of that office conference until the trial relating to this decision about how to proceed?
No, I'm not aware. There was no motions filed. There was no motions to amend. The last amended complaint in the first lawsuit was in April of 2009. There was never a formal motion to reopen the scheduling order to allow more motions. There was no motion to dismiss. There was no attempts to...
Well, you were present, and I talked about the cold record. Would you agree with my characterization of the, quote, cold record, that the judge was clearly concerned about how the plaintiffs were pursuing their case?
I think that's correct. I think the judge was concerned. We're 3 months before trial, and a large issue is now being presented at the first time while she's trying to decide summary judgment motions.
But she's very concerned.
Concerned, yes. Very concerned that this was a way to avoid amending the complaint by having a new lawsuit filed.
So my question to you is, based on the tone that I see in this conference, you indicate that when you left the conference, if they wanted to confer and say, you know, Judge, we've picked choice number two, that the judge would have welcomed that.
I think that would have probably prompted another office conference and objections by me, depending on exactly what all terms may have been negotiated with
this.
And then,
putting aside your reaction, one of the things we see on appeal is someone makes an objection, there's a ruling, you're still concerned about the ruling, you have to renew the objection to preserve it. At some point in time, when do you let it go? It's been preserved.
Yeah.
My question for you is, to the extent the office conference was a little confused that you have two choices, but then there's a ruling that says, here's my ruling and you no longer have a choice. My question is it realistic, based on the tone of that office conference, to think that the plaintiff's attorney could come back and say, you know, Judge, we've picked choice number two?
Yeah, I don't think that would have been having raised any ire with the trial judge. You know, she was concerned
The judge would have not been upset in the least that they came back and said, you know, we've picked choice number two.
Depends how it gets, you know, is it going to be another 2 years of discovery? Are we going to pick choice two? Are we going to agree? There's certainly scenarios.
Well, the judge would have had to deal with all of your objections.
Right, depending on what was presented. But my point is, when you're leaving this office conference, you know, there is a question of, you know, first trial, you know, first suit, second suit. And in the end, the plaintiffs did nothing to try to resolve their claim splitting issue, you know, not even a formal motion to amend to bring it in, a formal motion to dismiss one of the suits, or a formal motion so that there's a record that, okay, we asked to dismiss the first suit without prejudice and proceed with the second one. Defendants are objecting. Here's the court's ruling.
We understand that I'm looking at the docket, and there's motions to extend deadline for filing motions to add or amend. Apparently, that gets granted at some point?
Yeah, there was, I think, two of those, with the last one in April of '09.
So when was the, with all of the, how, well, first of all, how many extensions on motions to amend?
I think there was two.
And when was the final date for an amendments to be made?
It would have been somewhere around April 27th of '09. It would have been somewhere in that range, because there would have been a motion, there was a second motion to amend. It was cleaning up the docket, cleaning up the parties. There was third-party claims, fourth-party claims, and it was amended that second time by the plaintiffs. And I think it was something I may have even have started to try to, you know, clean up the docket a little bit, because I needed to do an amendment, because my client actually filed a pro se answer when they were first served. So that was the last time there was a extension of the motions to amend. I think there was two, because there was two amended complaints, and as far as I know, they were both granted. Now, that was still long before April of '09, is long before the August 2010 trial date, so that's not an issue. But by the time we get to the office conference, we're 3 months before, and I'd speculate a little bit what the judge would do, but they were certainly discussing options to avoid having two separate lawsuits. And by the end of the conference, when there was no agreement by the parties as to what to do, we're still left with the first lawsuit and a claim-splitting second lawsuit, with the plaintiff's counsel saying we have to discuss it, decide what we're going to do, and that's where it ended. And I don't think the court had a choice but to go ahead and proceed with both, you know, lawsuits. And but I preface all this with my earlier statement that I don't think this should have even been a choice which lawsuit gets to go forward. If you can't get your amended complaint in the first lawsuit, you don't get to split your claims with a second one. So
right,
I think
so. Your position, I mean, to cut right through it, is that there was clearly claim splitting that was being attempted here that was barred by res judicata.
It turned into race.
If there was any, you know, if that created a problem for the plaintiffs, it was a problem of their own making, because they could have resolved the claim splitting issue before the summary judgment decision was made.
They could have at least tried to resolve it with some sort of motions with the court to try to, since the consolidation was denied, there's no reason to do that again. But to dismiss the first one, something along those lines, and see our response and see what the court does. But the
solution to the problem was still within the power of the plaintiffs.
I think so. I think the solution was within them, from not filing a motion to amend a third time through filing the second complaint and not following up and not at least trying to pick which lawsuit officially and have some sort of documented pleadings.
Well, wasn't the motion to consolidate in effect a motion to amend? I mean, the practical outcome would have been the same as if there had been an amendment.
Except it's a different motion, and I think it's a little different standard, but we never really got that far, because we had the office conference and the court clearly was not going to allow, you know, a brand new claim to come in three months before trial.
My inquiry relates to, as a practical matter, there was a motion made which would have brought all of the theories and causes of action together.
Correct.
Which was denied and could have been appealed directly.
And it was. That was part of the first. I think I did order the transcript from the first hearing, and I actually filed a motion to strike that part of the appeal, which was delayed for this part of it, because that whole consolidation was briefed, argued, and affirmed in the first one. So I did file a motion, never did it before, a motion to strike that part of the appeal on this particular case for this appeal. All that has been resolved, and I don't think is any, you know, right for any sort of review, whether it should have been amended or consolidated. Essentially, you're correct, it's the same. It does happen, not infrequently, especially if there's a new plaintiff, and usually I see this come up in wrongful death cases where there's, you know, another cousin or a relative or someone that wasn't listed in the first complaint and the statute hasn't run yet, then it's a new plaintiff, and instead of doing the whole amendment, it's a separate lawsuit, and then those gets consolidated. Those happen. You know, I don't see it happening with the same plaintiff suing the same defendants to add a missing cause of action or a new cause of action. It's to get around the amendment is usually if there's a brand new party getting brought in and there's some sort of urgency, may take a few weeks to have a motion to amend, heard and granted. So that comes up, but it doesn't come up in this sort of situation that I've seen. But in conclusion, I think this was it started out as a claim splitting and the first case was still going and the second case was filed, and once the first case was dismissed, appealed, and affirmed, it turned into res judicata. All the conditions are there, and there should not be given a choice to decide which of your claim splitting cases should go forward. I ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It is clear from the record in this case, and if we look back further, one of the efforts that we made during the course of this case was to file a motion to compel against the defendants in the first case because we couldn't get the defendants to schedule depositions. To evidence the court's intolerance of this case, the court, and the transcript is in our briefing, was intolerant of our coming to the court asking for sanctions against the defense to schedule discovery. From the outset, the court seemed to be intolerant of the request that the plaintiff was making.
Let me say, the record supports what you just said. And I must say, I was surprised when I read the transcript when the court said, that's not the court's job if you figure it out. It seemed to me if you tried to figure out the scheduling and you couldn't, that's exactly what the court's supposed to do, is say, here's the answer. So having accepted the merits of the argument as being supported by the record, how does that get to be an issue in this appeal?
The first case was dismissed procedurally after the plaintiffs tried to do everything they could to preserve that claim. And this argument that the attractive nuisance was a new claim is simply silly. It was pled by reference, even though I understand that was argued and affirmed, but it was pled by reference in the first case. It's not as though the plaintiffs were trying to add a products liability claim 3 months before this trial. All we were trying to do was deal with the court's view that there was some new claim. And to evidence the fact that the court viewed that as a new claim, the court allowed the defense to add a reply brief to the motion for summary judgment on this new theory. We were doing everything we could to preserve that attractive nuisance claim that was pled in the first case. It was procedurally defaulted, and in the face of that procedural default made by the court, not by us, it was bootstrapped into dismissing the second case. And this court, the reasoning of Draco versus Hitchens is that cases should be decided on the merits and not on technicalities. I've gone through the factors supporting the fact that this case should be reversed under Draco, and it is my respectful request that this action be reversed and sent to the jury under the second complaint.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.